Hello, I'm Jordan Marr, and this is Farming in British Columbia, a podcast that gives itself permission to release episodes late during planting season. This episode, a conversation with farmer Paddy Doherty of West Enderby Farm. Paddy and his partner Elaine retired last year, but for close to 15 years they grew organic carrots and a couple other crops in the North Okanagan. Paddy and Elaine's reputation as solid farmers would have been enough to fill a whole interview, but there was a lot more I wanted to ask him about. He's a bit of a legend in BC's organic farming community, having played a pivotal role in some key moments of evolution of the organic farming sector. And before he and Elaine bought West Enderby Farm late in their careers, Paddy spent a few decades living and working on a couple of cooperative farms around Quesnel. He's also a wizard with old tractors, which have benefited some of his colleagues as he's thinned out his fleet in retirement. Including me, actually. Last fall, Paddy and Elaine sold me a 1948 Farmall Cub that I'll be using to cultivate my beans and corn this year. A longer version of this conversation has been published before, over at the Organic BC podcast, which I also host. It was too long to include all of it here at Farming in British Columbia, where my producer, the recent happy recipient of a 1948 Farmall Cub, takes a hard, fussy line on episode length. So if you like what you hear here, then head over to the Organic BC podcast to catch the rest of Paddy's thoughts or listen to around 60 other episodes. I spoke to Paddy in the summer of 2023 at his farm in the North Okanagan. Here's that conversation. Paddy Doherty, thanks so much for having me out to West Enderby Farm.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to have you.
Paddy, I have a lot I want to ask you about today, but I think we better start at the start, because in our chatter before the interview, it sounds like you didn't have much of a background in farming, so maybe you could tell me about how that changed.
Yeah, well, let's see, I graduated high school in 73, and then I went to university for a couple semesters and didn't really dig it and didn't really know what, you know, I was kind of at loose ends at that age. What is it, 17, 18? And then friends of mine picked up on this emerging commune in the Caribou. So I went up there and hung out there, and I really dug the lifestyle. And it's the first time I had like seen a cow, you know, or and done anything agriculture, but it really appealed to me. And so I lived there for a year or two, and then a few of us wanted our own commune. And so we split off and bought some property in the Caribou near Quesnel, and lived there for close to 40 years. Developed a little sheep ranch and homestead. We had about 500 acres, and grew our own, like, we had milk cow and pigs and chickens and the whole thing, and we had a flock of sheep, and we had a big commercial garden. We would sell vegetables in Quesnel at the farmer's market, and did that for a long time.
I think I've got to stop you there. Tell me about that commune in terms of what it was doing agriculturally, and who were the characters that were there?
Oh, there. Speaking of characters, like the there was a originator, a guy named Jerry Laborde, who he has a long history, and it really is, there should be a book written about him. Anyway, they're still going, and there's a vestige of them called Seeds, C-E-E-D-S, and he was an old communist, and he wanted to do something different, and he had experience in agriculture. So many of us learned a lot about gardening and farming from Jerry, and working with horses particularly. He really liked horses, and so we were working with draft horses, and that's what we did in Quesnel. For a long time we did all our work with horses. We put up our hay and did the cultivating and the garden and stuff. We had different teams of draft horses, and that was definitely a challenge, and it was interesting, and I learned a lot in the process. Did a lot of like blacksmithing and stuff, and, you know, repairing things. And it was kind of autocratic, right? Or not kind of, it was. So a few of us didn't like the you know, the dictatorial aspect of it. So we wanted to have our own place. And so that's where we bought the place in Quesnel. And so we lived there, like I said, close to 40 years, I think. And but about 20 years ago, I got together with my wife, Elaine. And eventually, Elaine and I wanted to do something different on our own. And we ended up through different... Like, first we went to Vancouver, and Elaine was teaching at UBC Farm, and I was working on with an international organization. By that time, I was like 55. So this is pretty late in life to be embarking on a new venture.
How old are you now, Patty?
Now I'm 68. So by 55 and having done a lot of different farming ventures, you know, and I worked for farmers too, like in the I drove combine on the prairies for a bit, and worked for beekeepers and stuff. And we had an idea of what we wanted to do. And I said, I don't want to screw around. I want a commercial farm. I don't want to be a poverty farmer anymore, you know.
Well, can I stop you there? We're gonna bring ourselves slowly towards this era, this past era. But right. because I really want to stop on that phrase. Like I wanted to be a commercial farmer. I didn't want to be a poverty farmer anymore. That's why I was asking about those communes. Tell me more. Like, you can skip to the second commune, the one you co-own. But like, describe the agriculture that was happening. Describe what was really working and maybe what wasn't working.
Well, it was kind of what you might call homestead agriculture, which is the kind of agriculture it was very common 100 years ago, where you'd have a family farm and they would grow just about everything, right? You know, have a big vegetable garden and pigs and chickens and milk cows and, you know, and some beef cow too, maybe a small herd of beef cow and horses and, you know, goats, sheep. And so we were really into that, into the kind of a self-sufficiency notion, you know, where we did an inventory of how many machines we had on the farm that had hand cranks on them, like the drill press and the cream separator and the wheat grinders, you know, like it was really quite enormous, the amount of the forge had a blower on it, the crank. It was kind of cool, like there was that many things that you operated by hand, and we were just into doing that. But all my life I've been like, I want to do something, then I do it, then I want to do something else. And this drives Elaine crazy, of course, because we're entirely different that way. You know, Elaine wants to do things really good, right? I just want to do them and then move on.
So somewhere on this farm, in partnerships, we make compromises. So somewhere on this farm, there's a hand crank forge that Elaine still uses to
no.
to scratch that itch.
No, me. I'm the crank guy.
Do you remember what it cost for that 500 acres up near Quesnel?
Yes. Well, we bought one farm, 160 acres, and then like 8 years later, so like 87 or something, we sold it and we bought another place. The other place cost us $103,000, and that was 170 acres with... how many feet, like 500 feet of riverfront, or is more than that, quarter mile of riverfront. And then associated with that was a ag leases, which you had to do a certain amount of work on and then you bought. So we bought two ag leases attached to this place that ended up bringing it from 170 to 500 acres over the years.
And were those reasonably priced?
Yeah, they were like 20,000 each or something, or yeah, around that, something, you know, like that. And you're supposed to log them in order to make farmland. That's the idea. So we did one of them. We did a lot of logging on it and cleared it up and made it into basically improved pasture. In fact, both of them mostly. It's for grazing for the sheep. And, well, we never made much money. The reasons we didn't make much money is because we didn't take advice. We were like most young people who we thought we just wanted to do what we wanted to do. And we weren't really, even though we were friends with all our, with all the neighbors, we were in good terms with all, like rancher neighbors, mm-hmm. right? We weren't going to really listen to them very much, you know? So we wanted to work with horses. Mm-hmm. We wanted sheep. We didn't want cows.
Because?
I don't know. Maybe sheep were easier to grab or something, you know, like, you know, cows are kind of intimidating, you know? Mm. And,
I got mugged by a cow once. That's a different story. We're going to focus on you, Pat.
So, but, you know, the sheep didn't make sense where we were. We had wolves, bears, coyotes, cougars, mm-hmm. you know, they all like to eat sheep. And you have to fence them. You can't, and we had range. We couldn't put them out on range, right? We had, I forget how many AUMs came with the place, you know. Anyway, the short story is that we struggled with the sheep for years and years. We had organic lamb. We used to ship it down to Vancouver and to Choices, I think. And we used to ship whole lamb, you know, down there from a slaughterhouse in Beaver Valley. But it was, we didn't have the volumes that you would need to, like, I don't know what it is now, but back then sort of the family farm income level for sheep would be around 500 ewes, you know, minimum. And we had maybe 200, and that was about max of what we could do. So they never, you know, we never made much money at it. And, but the vegetables were pretty lucrative. We did all right with that. Mm-hmm.
What I think about is, especially back then, it can have been a very dense population up there. I mean, my southern BC ignorance is probably showing, but I'm thinking back 40 or 50 years. I mean, but there were enough people that to sell to, or a sufficient lack of other.
Well, by the time we had a commercial market garden, that would have been in the early 90s by then. And we had a very vibrant, and they still have a very vibrant farmer's market in Quesnel, quite mm-hmm. a nice one. In fact, it's one of the nicest ones I've ever seen. I'm digressing, but it's not a parking lot. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful grassy field, you know. It's really, and it's comfortable. There's shade, there's benches, you know, they've thought of everything. There's toilets, you know. Mm-hmm. Compared with even around here, I'm not impressed with some of the farmers markets mm-hmm. around here. They're just parking lots, you know? Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah, they don't have the vibe, that's for sure. I agree.
Yeah.
So let's move on to talking about farming then. Okay. So like, you know, I really want to focus on, you know, your decision many years ago to focus on organic production. And so I'm just going to start at the start. Like, was that the focus even at the first commune? When did you really start to zero in on it?
Yeah, well, that was, I was raised to be an environmentalist and then picked it up very early, you know, like with Silent Spring and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So that was always my political point of view.
It's from my rough calculation, you were square smack in the middle of the Back to the Land movement.
Like, exactly. Yeah. And so organic farming just ticked all the boxes. So this was something. So I mentioned in my late teens, like I was, you know, at loose ends. This was, I wasn't the only one. You know, there was all kinds of young people that didn't know what they wanted to do. The life was pretty affluent then. It was easy to work. I worked at the shipyards for a while. Was making really good wages. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't a struggle to survive. What was difficult was figuring out what I wanted to do with my time. So being a farmer meant that I could do something that I enjoyed, didn't have to punch a time clock, and it fit my political aspirations, mm-hmm. right? Because it was organic farming. Mm-hmm. So that, and that I'm sure with a lot of people that in the organic movement, it's the same thing, right?
And so can you remember any of your early struggles or learning opportunities? Like back then, what were the biggest challenges with regards to organic production and figuring out a system that would work? What were some of the challenges that you remember?
Well, one of the biggest challenges was having bad ground, having bad soil, you know, living on a place it was full of rocks or, you know, so you couldn't farm much because you didn't have farmland. And then I said that we bought another farm. And so this place was down on the river bottom. So it was farmable, but pretty gravelly and sandy. So nice for carrots, but very low in nutrition. So we did struggle with like hay crops, you know, like not getting much production. And that's one of the reasons we weren't that profitable, is because we weren't getting much from our fields, you know. We had irrigation, which was as smart of us, as one a good choice we made very early on. There was these incredible loans you could get from the Minister of Agriculture back then for infrastructure. It was super good deal. I think we borrowed $25,000 to put in a really good system, you know. And then the interest rate was 2%. And you could save money easily at 7% then,
right.
you know. So yeah, it was a sort of an, even for us who are very averse to debt averse, we still saw the value of this, and it was a good thing to do. So we had irrigation, but we didn't have a good nutrition plan. And I always remember, like, I had one field, just a little, it might have been like 3 acres tops, nice little field. And I got like six bales from it. And when this is from one cutting, and this is with irrigating it, right? So it's not, and our bales are about 700 pounds. The next year, I got a bunch of horse manure from the neighbor and borrowed a manure spreader, and I put it all on this field just on top of the grass before it started up in the spring. I got 42 bales. I mean, the seasons are different, but still.
Sure.
But it was obvious, you know, that we just didn't have the nutrition we needed.
Back then, were you already clued into cover cropping as a means to do that?
Yeah, we did. We had a rotation. We used sweet clover, and you could tell the difference after a sweet clover plow down, you know. But still, we were in gravel soil, you know. So it can only do so much. You know, you can't change the type of soil you've got,
right?
You know. So it needed constant. Once we started, we had about 6 acres in garden. Once we started doing that, of course, we needed every bit of nutrition for the garden, right? You know, because you know how much they demand.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
And so was it just truckloads of horse manure, or what were you doing?
Oh, well, we had the livestock. So, you know, we had a fair bit of livestock. We still had about 200 ewes, and we would butcher on the farm. And everything we butchered, we would compost in these big piles of compost, and including the hides, you know. And so that was pretty rich.
Yeah,
right. You know? And that would go on the garden.
Okay, so fasting forward.
Yes.
We're going to come back to production, but tell me at what point, because I have no sense of the timeline. Because it sounds like you were up there longer than I appreciated.
Right.
So at what point did you start getting involved with what we'll just call organic sector development? So in the culture, organic is starting to take on, I'm assuming, meaning. So can you, because like, what is that, in the 80s where that started happening?
Late 80s for me, much earlier for the movement, you know, like in California and in Germany and stuff. But it was late 80s for me. And then probably 1990, SUPA started, something around then, or maybe a little earlier, maybe 89 or something. I can't remember. And then...
The South Okanagan Organic Producers Association.
Yes, yeah, you're right. So... a buddy of ours, he had a little homestead, and he was actually growing like little small amounts of fruit, like apples and things, and plums, I think, on the Fraser River in a kind of a microclimate. And he got the idea of forming our own certification body in the Caribou, because these things were popping up all over BC, right?
And can I stop you there and just ask you to confirm, and I'm going to intentionally keep it simple and risk oversimplifying, but that's okay. But they were popping up because this idea of organic food was really starting to develop meaning in the marketplace.
Yes, exactly.
But then that brought about this need to start to create an agreed upon set of principles or standards.
Standards, yeah.
Which helps the whole movement be able to market the farm products.
Yeah, and that isn't oversimplifying. That's perfect.
Okay.
So
you guys decide to start your own association.
Yes, yeah, and I got involved in that and started enjoying doing this, because for many years all I've been doing is farming and working with my hands, right? So I started doing some intellectual work, which for the first time since high school, right, or university. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the challenge and thinking and writing and stuff. So I just started doing more of that and getting more involved. And then when these disparate certification bodies started to come together to form a provincial organization, I got involved in that. And you just keep stuck with it. That's all.
All right, Patty, I really want to spend most of the rest of our conversation just talking about farming and specifically what you've done here at West Enderby Farm. So I'm going to start at the end and then we'll go back to the start your time here. Like, right. Is it fair to say you're in a move towards retirement right now? Like, is that, well, I'm asking, the evidence I see is you're selling off a lot of machinery. Like, it seems that's happening. Is that correct?
That's correct. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So we bought this place in 2010. I told Elaine I would do it for 10 years. I was 55 then.
Yeah.
So last year, 2022, was our last commercial crop in my, unless things change.
Yeah.
We grew cauliflower, and we grew a lot of cauliflower actually last year.
Yeah.
And, but this year, none. You can look around, we've got cover crops. Down there, that's cover crops. That's in fallow. Behind you is fall rye. And then 15 acres where the blue things are, that's leased.
Yeah.
For organic alfalfa seed.
Elaine mentioned organic alfalfa seed. Cool. Okay. And so I want to... Okay. So now let's go back to 13 years ago then, right? So you've had all this experience up north to inform. Now you have a chance to start fresh. You wanted to start fresh. What were your deal breakers when you bought a new farm? Like, I have to imagine the quality of the soil mattered, given what you described about what you dealt with up there.
Yeah, we wanted good ground and water. Those two things were very important. And a really crappy house was bizarrely part of the thing too, because it meant we could afford it.
Are you comfortable sharing what you had to spend on this farm? It's okay if you're not.
Oh, yeah.
I think people are always interested.
So this is 40 acres when we bought it.
With a self-described crappy house.
Oh, yeah. I don't mind saying that the realtor put in the ad, you might be able to live in the house while you built new.
Right.
That was the way she wrote it.
This is the house I just plugged into that you still live in 13 years later.
Well, yeah, duh. So... back then, when we bought it in 2010, irrigated farmland in this area was $15,000 an acre.
Mm-hmm.
So we paid $563 for this place.
Okay.
And then now it's like, I don't know, $36,000 an acre, something mm-hmm. like that. And we struggled for quite a few years. We didn't have any money, but we had scraped enough for a down payment, right? And then I was working for ICEAL for another 4 years, which was really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working full time, getting paid pretty well. And the second year, I think, we made money because we knew what we wanted to do.
And what was that? What did you know you wanted to do when you set up here?
Oh, we wanted to grow carrots
And why?
Because they're easy to sell. People want carrots. And I felt we could grow them.
Cougars and wolves and bears don't bother you.
No, yeah, it's true. I didn't want livestock. I'm not really, I'm too self-centered to be really that great with animals.
That's a great way of putting it. I think you just described me. I like animals when they're owned by other people.
Well, you have to put them first, Jordan.
Yeah, but now that's a little bit. Now I'm just realizing I've chosen to have kids in the last few years, and I've just confessed something that I maybe shouldn't have. Anyway, I like that. I like that framing. I'm too self-centered. I see that in myself when I visit my friends' livestock farms.
Yeah, like you. You know, when you're lambing or even like breakfast, you know, you have to go feed them first before you eat, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And you got to put them first because mm-hmm. they're reliant on you. And it's a lot easier to do that with your kids, okay?
Well, no, I'm starting to picture all the breakfast that I eat first, but anyway, they're still okay. I won't see the consequences of my decisions till they're older and they resent me, but for now it's fine.
Yeah. So, yeah, we chose carrots. First off, we negated a few things. One of the first things was we're not going to the farmer's market. We're not going to show up at Armstrong competing with our friends mm-hmm. with 10 acres of vegetables, yeah. right? So that was out. So we want to sell to local grocery stores mm-hmm. was our main, what we wanted to do. And we came into it right when this local thing was happening, like, in 2010 was, you were starting to hear all this local bullshit was going on. Like way back when we went to talk to the grocery stores, they would be condescending and not very nice to us generally. Mm. You know, the produce manager didn't want to, you know, really deal with this. Although we did, remember one summer in Quesnel, we sold romaine lettuce to Save On Foods all summer long. Mm. And that taught us how much a crop of romaine takes out of your ground, eh?
Mm.
Yeah, you really had to, you know, you couldn't just replant.
You had to bring in truckloads of gravel to replace the gravel that you took out of there.
Anyway, I just wanted, I had, for some reason, I wanted to grow carrots, even though this isn't really good carrot ground. The carrots grow well, but it's hard to work, mm. you know. But So I said, like, within a few years, we were making money, you know. And then Elaine's like a, she's got a degree in agricultural botany from Aberystwyth in Wales. Like, mm-hmm. she knows her stuff. And then I'm good with, we decided we're just going to buy junk and make it work, mm-hmm. you know. So we already had a lot of debt. We didn't want to go into debt, more debt, you know. And we just got junk and
old tractors as a representation. Like, you're not buying new. You're buying old
stuff and making it go. Yeah. Old irrigation stuff and making it yeah. go. Old harvesting stuff. The carrot harvester was 1962. Mm-hmm. Also, along with that philosophy is the notion that I'm 55.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go into an enormous.
Right, you can't realize the value in the new equipment.
Yep. No, or the physical plant.
Mm-hmm.
We had a nice old barn. I mean, actually, it wasn't nice when we first came here, but it's good size. You know, we were able to make use of that. And
the realtor said, your cows could live in this barn until you build a new one for them.
It was full of chicken shit about at least 2 feet mm-hmm. deep. It was awful. So yeah, we just made it. We made it work, and the labor was a struggle, but we always did. You know, we just worked at it, and Elaine is good that way. You know, and we were getting right when we our last crop of carrots. We were really getting good at growing carrots,
mm-hmm.
but it took about 10 years.
Yeah. And what was the hardest when you say you got good? What was the hardest part to master?
Probably the hardest part of growing carrots is getting a nice uniform row of carrots that is 1 inch high. Right.
Right.
Once you've got that.
Ahead of the weeds, you mean? Is that baked in there? Yeah. Getting them like germinated evenly, 1 inch high with no weed pressure.
So that includes a whole strategy around weeds, mm-hmm. but also seeding. You know, really good at getting the seed down.
Sure.
And then it took trial and error. We learned that we had to roll this ground. After we had to irrigate before we planted.
Yeah.
We had to plant, and then we had to roll it. We had a big, heavy roller, mm-hmm. bed roller made up, and we...
For moisture conservation?
No, because our ground is so hard mm-hmm. and clumpy that we would get a situation where you'd plant the seed into this. The best we could get, we couldn't get powder, mm-hmm. soil powder. We could get aggregate, the size of your baby finger.
Sure.
So the seed would not be in contact with the ground, right?
Yeah.
And then it didn't get that signal to germinate.
So you just get spottiness through your whole plant.
In some cases, we would get nothing come up. Uh-huh. I planted 10 beds over there in new ground, so it was really rough.
Yeah.
And I rolled one.
Okay. I'm going to stop you because this is a fun opportunity to like give people a picture, right?
Yeah.
So what's a typical... Just at any point in your carrot production, is a typical plot that you're going to put carrots in half an acre, like how big? Just give me an example for a...
So they're 600-foot rows,
uh-huh.
beds, 600-foot beds,
yeah.
four rows to a bed.
Okay.
And a bed is about 5 feet wide.
Okay, so 5 feet wide by 600 feet with four rows in it.
Yeah, so I'd say 20 of them, like, so maybe 2 acres would be a block of carrots.
Sure. Well, you know what? We can just focus on that one 600-foot bed in a planting, right? So let's just assume you've prepared the soil to a degree you like. I'm not going to dwell on that. Now we're ready to plant. You're going to pre-irrigate?
Yeah. And a vegetable farmer in Cloverdale taught me that.
Yeah.
I was looking at some equipment, and he said, "You're growing carrots?" Or we were talking about carrots, and he said, "Do you irrigate before you plant?" And I said, "No, you do it afterwards." And he said, "Irrigate before you plant."
Mm-hmm.
He's an old guy, you know, and so I did it. And yeah, I don't know what it does, but we irrigate before we plant, and it has to be, and then the soil has to be, you know, you can get on it, right? It's not really wet. And then we eventually got a stand hay drill, a four-row drill.
Yeah, was it Robbins or vacuum?
No, it's old school.
Okay, okay.
Ground driven.
All mechanical. Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, with belts.
All right, so stop there. What tractor is pulling that stand hay? People are interested.
Yeah, okay, well, we bought this old Massey 165. I got it in the coast that was a vegetable tractor.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to set it up wide enough so it straddles this 5-foot bed.
Yeah.
You know, so it's running down this bed with the... with the stand hay behind it.
Okay, so you pre-irrigated, you run down with the stand hay, then next comes the roller, once you made that insight?
And the same tractor pulls the roller, and the roller's the right width.
Okay.
It's a really heavy roller.
Okay.
Like a heavy, heavy steel pipe full of water.
Right.
And it was about 2 feet around our diameter.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we irrigate.
Right. And then what's your next move? I have to assume it's a cultivation move.
No. The next move in 7 days will flame it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We had I've got it in the barn still. We had it made up. It's on wheels with a tank.
And it was 7 days? That seems late. Like that would seem like you're risking burning the carrots.
Always 7 days.
Okay.
Sometimes it was way too early.
Right.
But we waited 7 days, and then because we wanted the weeds to come up, right?
Sure.
And if you irrigate, like there's different ways to do it. Like you could irrigate before you plant, then flame, then plant, then irrigate, then flame again. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's different ways to do a stale seed bed. You know, but this is what we
did. This was you. 7 days, one flame.
Yeah, and it usually worked pretty good. That gave us a good break for the carrots to come up.
Mm-hmm.
The some of the weeds are slow, like amaranth or red-rooted pigweed is slow to germinate. and it'll come up after you flame. Mm-hmm. It's just a nasty weed. The same with wild millet. Mm-hmm. And wild millet, the flaming doesn't really kill it anyway.
Right.
So as soon as the carrots are up, late in the day when the light is a certain way, mm-hmm. you know, Elaine will come go out there with the basket weeder. And when we got it on the electric tractor, then she could just, because it's electric, you can just turn it down. You can go as slow as you feel
sure.
like, right? You know, you're not having to ride the clutch or anything. So anyway, she would get the basket weeder on it as soon as she could. And go.
Same tractor?
Sorry?
Same tractor?
Oh, no. This is on an LSG that's set up with to straddle the bed as well.
Right. Okay.
So it's a it's a belly.
You're looking straight down.
Looking straight down.
Yeah.
And she's going really slow.
Yeah.
Right? And then what that does is it marks the rows.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you can barely see the carrots, you can see the rows now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So after that, you can go roaring up and down mm-hmm. with the basket weeder.
Oh, I see. Like. One pass just to mark the rows where she can be really precise.
Yeah.
Now you can roar. Because the basket weeders want speed to do their job, right?
Yeah, to do a decent job.
Right.
And, of course, the basket isn't as wide. Like, it's not, there's still space
mm-hmm.
because you just can't do it, you know, like that precise.
Hard to dial it in, sure.
Yeah. So if you're really careful, you can go down beside one carrot row. Then you turn around and go beside the next carrot row. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're doing four rows.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to, the stand hay really helped that with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you're planting precise, mm-hmm. right? They're just going to plant, you know, where you're driving.
Yeah.
And so we would keep doing that until the stand hay's not, the basket weeder isn't working anymore. Like the weeds are too big.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had another tool. With the knife on it.
Yeah.
Which was very precise, and we would go through with that carefully.
Same tractor as the...
It was on another LSG.
I see. Okay.
Because it's hard to put these
tools... Remount them?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're a big guy like you...
Yeah.
You just knock a couple of wedges and pull the thing out, and then you pull the other one in. But if you're not really strong, it's hard.
You know? But another benefit of, like, having cheap old tractors, if you can maintain them, is you can just have they all ready to go, and you haven't had to adjust them or anything. Yeah.
And then when the carrots got to be... At that point, what I'm describing, the carrots, they're 3 inches tall, and we're still basket weeding. Then we got to do a hand weeding in the row.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So at your scale, that's still a reality.
Yeah. So we employed kids when we could, like from the high school or just people. And we would try and, we would start at 7 and work until 11 or noon.
Yeah.
That was it. So it worked good with high school kids. Like they came as a group, they knew each other and, you know, we'd work together. Then at noon, they'd go have the rest of their day. They'd go to the beach.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, we would
with
do
a,
that.
You know, big bag of carrots. They've just been paid off to the beach. You know, teenagers there.
They like carrots.
Probably throwing them off some overpass. You probably caused a few accidents with this weeding scheme of yours, hey?
they were great. We really liked, it was hard to recruit employees, but we really liked the employees we had.
Yeah.
They worked well. And, but I found like 5 hours of weeding on my hands and knees was when I got to be like 60 years old, that was tough. You know, I couldn't do much the rest of the day. Had to be pretty quiet. You know? And, that would take a few, we would plant late. This was in July now. We plant our carrots really late, like mid June early to mid June. And this was in July. And then once they've had one hand weeding, then usually it was time to go through with the hillers. We had hillers that did a beautiful job.
Mm-hmm.
And that was easy. You just drive through and hill them up. And you could do it maybe twice. And then when the carrots are, you know, they're over a foot high, you know what it's like. They shade themselves.
Sure, and you've won the lion's share of the battle.
Yeah.
You're going to get a good harvest if you've done it well up to that point.
Yeah.
And then, what is your preferred digging fork for harvesting your carrots?
Oh, we always use
that's
the harvester.
That's a joke. Yeah, no, I assume you have a harvester. So undercutting. Okay, so Patty, we've given people a little bit of a snapshot of the carrot production. That's good enough. I just love to give people a visual. Okay,
yeah,
so
pictures too.
We're gonna end our interview on mostly kind of lightning round type questions.
Okay,
right?
Great.
Because it's fun and people will be curious. What do you consider in the context of West Enderby Farm, this farm and your carrot operation, what are one or two of the most important investments you made?
Well, we bought a barrel washer that came up for sale, and we weren't really ready for it. The same with the carrot harvester. Mm. But we had big plans, and we could see where we were headed, right? So we went ahead and bought those things, and they were really. And then I've got one cooler left, but I had a number of these
tractor trailer based coolers.
Yeah, and they were really important. Yeah.
So in the case of the harvester and the washer, just for efficiency, I would imagine mainly
for volume.
Yeah. I just think this is maybe going to segue into another question, and I want to ask you about advice you have for up-and-coming farmers, for newer farmers. And I'll offer that maybe I've observed that, like, young or new farmers, maybe a good percentage of them spend too much time shying away from investments that mean they are both way less efficient and less happy because it's just harder.
Yeah, it's a tough one. You could look to successful commercial farmers, right? Mm. What are they doing? Why are they so rich, basically? Mm. And the main thing, I mean, this is a business thing anyway, like, it's not just farming. They're not afraid of debt.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Is that suggesting that your debt averseness, you're not entirely, like, that you would,
yeah,
you,
it,
you would take
it,
another
it
look at?
It held us back, for sure. You know, in my case, there's a nuance to it in terms of my age.
Mm-hmm.
So I came into this place late in life, so it didn't make sense to do a lot of investment. But if I had been 45 instead of 55, we could have bought those houses across the street for really cheap.
A song and what, put employees in them? What do you
think?
Yeah.
We could have put employees in them.
Yeah.
Either
foreign worker program type stuff, yeah,
or not, you know.
Yeah.
Well, whoever, but that would have made getting employees so much easier, right? And they would have been an investment too. Actually, I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, then you have to service that debt, of course.
Yeah.
So you end up being on this treadmill, and that can make you unhappy, right? The stress of
the debt, but you think there's a balance to be found.
Well, I think the key is, too many farmers, their farm is their life, it's their home,
mm-hmm.
right? So if the farm is a business that can win or lose, then it's different,
mm-hmm.
you know. So you have a business, and you go into debt to run your business, and the business either pays for itself or doesn't, you know, but you're not bereft and homeless.
Yeah,
if
there's
it goes
higher
under.
Stakes if it's your, it's
yeah,
where you're making
yeah.
your life. Yeah.
So I never really investigated that, but I'm sure there's ways, you know, to manage that so that your farm is more of a business than it is your everything. You know.
Mini tangent then. You mentioned these great loans from the government for irrigation like 40, 50 years ago, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years ago. The amount of different ag programs that are aimed at farmers now is dizzying, but they're not all effective. And it sounds like I'm going to infer that you really think that was a good program.
I don't know why they stopped it.
Low interest loans that are like...
Yeah, for infrastructure. It had a name, you know. I after a while, it might come to me, but yeah, it made a lot of sense. We put in irrigation, but you could build a barn, you know, you could build a silo,
mm-hmm.
you could, you know, do all kinds of things. And I don't remember them even asking. This is kind of silly, but how you're going to pay it back. Whereas, you know, if you go to the bank, yeah. you know, they
want a plan.
Well, and they want off-farm income.
Yeah.
Right? Generally, you know, they, it's really tough for young people without, you know, the farmer credit was good with us then. But even when we bought this place, I was working, being paid really well, and Elaine was working at UBC Farm. Mm. That's how we were able to convince Farm Credit to give us a loan. Mm. Without, if we were just saying, well, this is our business plan and we're going to make money, I don't know. After a few years, yeah, we could have gone back and they would have seen
some
yeah,
revenue.
Yeah, and they would have probably given us another $500,000 easy, you know. But we struggled on regardless.
Yeah. Okay, any other, that was, I led you to that answer debt. What, any other advice for the younger generation?
Well, it's hard, but listen to advice. So, like I said, we didn't listen to advice in our previous, you know, enterprises. When we came here, I said to myself that I would. Now, I didn't all the time. Like Herman told us, don't try and harvest in September, basically, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, it starts raining. And we didn't listen to him, and you know, we had a horrible struggle, like the mud. But we got linked up with Destin in Coston, and he was just a joy, like he was an angel to us. Mm-hmm. And because he'd been growing carrots for over 20 years, and we basically did what Destin does, mm-hmm. almost right to the kind of scales we use to pack the carrots, you know. Like we just asked Dustin and he showed us everything, and it made it so easy, you know, like we had to learn, like he had sandy soil. So
you had to apply it to your local conditions. Yeah.
But in terms of like, when you're commercially vegetable farming, half of it is growing, half of it is logistics, mm-hmm. like handling procedures, mm-hmm. you know, how you move carrots around without. I only picked up a carrot once, and that was when I put it in a bag for the store.
Right. Oh, that's a fun detail.
Yeah. Otherwise, it was all mechanized. We never had to handle the carrots, except for bagging.
Right.
There was some sorting on the production.
Liar.
I didn't do it.
You liar, Patty.
No, I didn't do it personally, but our employees did.
Right. All right. So be open to advice. That's a good one. Okay. This is a related question, or maybe not really, but what are you personally, what were your greatest assets that led to any successes you had?
My perseverance, mm-hmm. you know, I'm stick-to-itiveness kind of thing. And then I have to give Elaine, most of the credit, like marketing. Mm-hmm. She's really good with dealing with people. And as I said, carrots aren't hard to sell. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to sell carrots when we had, you know, 50 tons than it is if we had like 800 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, like it's a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Because you go to a retail store and you say, well, we can supply you from the end of September until March 1st, mm-hmm. you know, that sounds pretty good, you know, whereas if we got a few carrots right now,
yeah.
you know.
Are you okay if we contact you every third week sometimes because we have a sack of carrots?
Yeah.
Patty, who are your mentors? Do you want to single out one or two that were really important?
Herman Bruns was really good. Mm-hmm. He's really helpful. And because he's in the same geoclimatic, same soil, in fact, you know, he's really helpful in terms of, and he'd been doing it for 20 years before we moved here. Mm-hmm. So, but all the guys like Heino was super helpful, and Rob Hettler, you know, all the local guys that we hung out with, or women as well.
Patty Doherty. Thank you. Thank you for having me out to your beautiful farm in Enderby, and for making all this time to share a lifetime of farming experiences with whoever's going to listen to this.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Yeah, we should do it again. Okay,
What do you think, Patty?
Okay, great. It's a wrap.
So here's a quick Patty anecdote that's pretty recent. A great thing about buying a tractor from Patty, especially for those like me farming just down the road, is that Patty will happily help you troubleshoot any problems that come up. This is pretty crucial for me. If Patty's a mechanical wizard, I'm a mechanical idiot. And so a couple of weeks ago, I asked him to come by my farm to give me a rundown of the cub I purchased from him last fall. He kindly obliged me. I made it through most of the session without saying anything really stupid. And then, right at the end, I took a deep breath and told Patty I had a dumb question for him. I asked it, and he paused and looked at me and said, "Jordan, that really is a dumb question." And, like, the question was so dumb that a few minutes later, just before he left, Patty felt the need to reassure me by saying, "Jordan, don't worry, I'm not going to tell anyone about that question you asked me." And then I looked over to my right, and the dignity that had just left my body was just staring at me, shaking its head. And since I know you're curious, the question I asked Patty was, anyway, that's it for this episode. Hey, you know what I'd love, since this is an audio medium? Send me a voice memo. It's really easy. Use WhatsApp or Signal or even your regular texting app or email to tell me what you like or loathe about the show, or to suggest a future guest, or if you have some used farm equipment you want to sell, tell me the essential details. You can pause and cough and make mistakes. If I put it in an episode, I will clean it up. You can email voice memos to podcast@farminginbc.ca or message them to this number, 250-767-6636. 250-767-6636. Farmers are standing by. And now it's time to say goodbye. But remember, everyone, we have a lot more in common than all our differences would suggest. Thanks for listening.